When Israeli secret agents finally got their hands on the Vera Liebel file in the Austrian archives, what they found was an empty folder, the contents of which had seemingly evaporated. In June 1952, Vera Liebel and her three sons, Horst, Dieter, and Klaus, vanished from their home in Austria. In early July, they surfaced briefly in Genoa, and on July 28th, they came ashore in Buenos Aires. On August 15th, they got off the train in the dusty Tucumán station. Vera Eichmann, Moshe Perlman wrote in his book, still carried in her memory the picture of the dashing Nazi officer who looked so impressive in his dress uniform and shining boots. But the man who waited for her on the Tucumán platform was a middle-aged man, modestly dressed, his face pale and wrinkled, his expression depressed, and his walk slow. This was her Adolf. Eichmann the Terrible had become unrecognizable. He had gotten thin and was balding, his cheeks were sunken, and his face had lost the air of arrogance that had been so characteristic of him. He appeared resigned and anxious. Only his thin lips still suggested cruelty and malice. In 1953, Capri went bankrupt, and Eichmann had to search for a job. First, he tried opening a laundry in Buenos Aires with two other Nazis, then worked on a rabbit farm, and later in a fruit juice cannery. Finally, with the help of another secret Nazi organization, Ricardo Clement was appointed a foreman at the Mercedes-Benz assembly plant in Suarez. By then, he had started believing that he would end his life peacefully. Until May 11, 1960. Meanwhile, Eichmann's sons searched for him in hospitals, morgues, and police stations. They turned for help to the fascist Peronist youth organization Taquara, which joined the search. But Eichmann's sons soon concluded that the Israelis must have captured their father. They then tried, but failed, to convince the pro-Nazi organizations to take some drastic action, perhaps kidnap the Israeli ambassador and hold him until their father was released. But the Argentinians refused. Isser instructed his men about what to do if the hideout was located by the police. If they raid the base, Isser said, Eichmann should be rushed to the secret chamber that had been prepared inside the house. If the police set out to do a thorough search, Eichmann was to be whisked out of the house by a side exit that had been specifically set for such an emergency. Several agents were to escape with Eichmann, while the others were to do anything possible to hinder the search, despite the risks that might involve. To whoever would be with Eichmann, Isser said, "If the police find the hideout and break in, handcuff yourself to him and throw away the keys so they won't be able to tear you away from him. Tell them that you're Israeli, and together with your friends you have captured the world's most hated criminal, Adolf Eichmann, in order to bring him to trial. Then give the police my real name, Isser Harel, as well as my false identity, and the name of the hotel where I am staying. If they get hold of you and of Eichmann, I'm to be arrested as well." A few days later, Eichmann agreed to sign a document, stipulating that he was willing to be taken to Israel and put on trial there. It read, "I, the undersigned Adolf Eichmann, of my own free will, hereby declare, now that my real identity has been discovered, I recognize that there is no further use in trying to evade the course of justice. I agree to be taken to Israel and stand trial before a qualified tribunal. It is understood that I shall be given the assistance of an advocate and that I shall be permitted to lay before the court, without travesty of the facts, an account of the last years of my service in Germany, so that a truthful description of those events may be passed on to the future generations. I am making this declaration of my own accord. Nothing has been promised to me and I have not been threatened. My desire is to find inner peace at last." as I am unable to remember all the details and may become confused when stating the facts, I ask that the relevant documents and testimonies be placed at my disposal to help me in my efforts to establish the truth. Adolf Eichmann, Buenos Aires, May 1960. This declaration, of course, had no legal validity. The plane arrives. May 18, 1960, 11 a.m. A formal ceremony took place at Lod International Airport near Tel Aviv. Many high-ranking personalities, including the Chief of Staff, General Laskov, the Director General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and the Argentinian Ambassador to Israel, came to see off the impressive delegation to Argentina for the 150th anniversary celebration. The El Al Whispering Giant took off, also carrying some regular passengers bound for stopovers along the way. Few of the passengers noticed that in Rome, three more civilians came aboard. After a couple of hours, these new passengers had become El Al crew members and were moving in the aisles in El Al uniforms. Actually, they were Mossad agents en route to assist their colleagues in Buenos Aires. One of them was Yehuda Carmel, a bald fellow with a prominent nose and a thin mustache. He was not very happy about this trip. He knew he had been chosen not because of his talents, but because of his outward appearance. A few days earlier, he had been called to his boss's office, where he saw two photos on the desk, his own and one of an unknown man. They looked very similar. When he was told that the unknown man was Adolf Eichmann, he shuddered. He was even more shocked when he was told that he had been chosen to serve as Eichmann's double. Isser's plan was to bring Carmel to Argentina as an El Al crew member, to take his uniform and documents, and then use these to get a drugged Eichmann on the plane. Carmel carried an Israeli passport in the name of Ze'ev Zachroni. Isser had also prepared a backup plan. He summoned, with the help of a go-between, a young kibbutz member, Meir Barhon, who was visiting relatives in Buenos Aires. Meir was asked to come to Bar Gloria on Bartolome Mitre Avenue, where two men were waiting for him, Isser and Dr. Elian. Isser instructed him, "When you return to your relative's home, call a doctor and tell him that you were in a car accident and that you suffer from dizziness, nausea, and general weakness. The doctor will likely conclude that you suffer from a concussion and will put you in a hospital. On May 19th in the morning, you'll tell him that you feel much better and you'll ask to go home. You'll be discharged and the hospital will provide you with a document certifying you have been treated for a concussion." Dr. Elian then briefed Meir on the specific concussion symptoms that he should present. Meir left Bar Gloria and followed Isser's instructions. He lay there and moaned for 3 days in a big Buenos Aires hospital. On May 19th, he was discharged. An hour later, Isser held in his hands an official hospital document issued to Meir Barhon, certifying that he had been discharged after being hurt in a car accident. So, if the plan to smuggle Eichmann out of Argentina as an El Al crew member were to fail, Isser would have him put on a stretcher and carried to the plane as Meir Barhon, a patient still suffering from a serious concussion. May 19th. That afternoon, the El Al plane landed in Buenos Aires. Protocol officials from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, enthusiastic local Jews, and children carrying little blue and white flags stood on both sides of the red carpet laid by the gangway. A couple of hours later, Isser conferred with the pilot, Tzvi Tohar, and an El Al executive and fixed the takeoff time, May 20th at midnight. Isser presented his plans. After a short discussion, they agreed to go for Plan A. Eichmann would be brought aboard as a crew member who had been taken ill. His double, Yehuda Carmel, had already turned over his uniform and documents in the name of Ze'ev Zichroni, an El Al navigator, to the Mossad team. Shalom Dani, the team's master forger, doctored the documents so as to fit Eichmann perfectly. Carmel was given new documents and told that he would leave Argentina sometime soon. That evening, a beehive of activity took over the base. After a week of strained waiting, the Mossad agents sprang back to life. Eichmann was drugged and fell asleep. The agents meticulously stripped the house. The various instruments and devices were all disassembled, the personal effects packed, and the house fully restored to its previous state. By the wee hours, nothing remained that could even hint at the role the villa had played in the last 8 days, and similar actions took place in all the other safe houses. May 20th. Isser left his hotel for the last time, hailed a cab to the railroad station, and checked his luggage. Then, he resumed his cafe routine of the previous days. The El Al people were the first to report to him, and together they prepared a detailed timetable. At midday, the last stage began. Isser paid his check at the final cafe he visited, picked up his luggage, and drove to the airport to oversee the escape operation. He walked through the terminal, looking for a place where he could best set up his command post. He wandered through the shopping and ticketing areas and finally discovered the cafeteria for airport employees. Outside, it was bitterly cold, and the cafeteria teemed with clerks, ground crew, and flight personnel who all came in for a hot drink or a light meal. Isser was delighted. This was ideal. Nobody would notice him or become aware of his hurried and hushed consultations with his men. Isser waited until a chair was vacated, and from it he now began to supervise the final moves on Argentinian soil. Hi, El Al. 9 p.m. In the safe house, all was ready. Eichmann was washed, shaved, dressed in an El Al uniform, and had in his pocket an ID in the name of Ze'ev Zichroni. His face was so well made up that even his own son wouldn't have recognized him. The doctor and two agents were also in El Al uniforms. The doctor injected Eichmann with a drug that didn't put him to sleep, but only blurred his senses. He was able to hear and see and even walk, but he couldn't speak and didn't quite understand what was happening. Aharoni, also wearing an El Al uniform, took the wheel of the car and an agent sat beside him. Eichmann was put in the back seat, between the doctor and another Mossad agent. The car set out. At the same time, two other cars departed from a popular hotel in the city center. These cars carried the real El Al crew. Their trip to the airport was meticulously synchronized with the progress of the Mossad vehicles. In his improvised command post, Isser received minute-by-minute updates. He ordered his men's baggage to be brought to the airport. He had prepared individual escape routes for each one, but if the main plan proceeded smoothly, they would all leave Argentina on the El Al aircraft. Not far from Isser, Shalom Dani was sipping from a steaming mug of black coffee. Passers-by had no idea that this customer had a lot of cheek. He had set up his forgery lab under their very eyes and was busy doctoring the passports of the Mossad agents, putting in all the necessary stamps and inscriptions to allow for their easy departure. 11 p.m. A man materialized next to Isser. All the cars, Mossad and El Al, had arrived, he reported. Isser hurried to the parking lot and checked the El Al cars. The crew members were silent. They sensed that they were participating in something extraordinary, but had no idea what it was. They listened to Isser's instructions quietly and asked no questions. Isser peeked into the third car, where Eichmann was dozing between his escorts. Go, he said. Good luck. The three cars moved ahead, while Isser returned to the terminal. The little convoy reached the Argentinian Airlines barrier. The Israeli aircraft was parked in their lot. "Hi, El Al," one of the Israelis merrily called. The guards recognized him and were, in fact, used to the Israelis going in and out of their lot all day. They cast a weary look at the passengers in the three vehicles, all dressed in El Al uniforms. In two of the cars, the passengers were singing, laughing, and loudly chatting, while those in the third car were asleep in their seats. The barrier was raised, and all three cars drove toward the plane. Their doors opened, and the dozen or so uniformed men moved in a cluster toward the gangway. Eichmann trudged in their middle, largely concealed by the others. Two men held him, helped him up the stairs, and placed him by a window in first class. The doctor and the security team spread out on the seats around him and pretended to be asleep. If Argentinian immigration officers were to come and check their papers, they were to be told that these are the men who work the second shift and need to rest before the next leg of the flight. 11:15 p.m. Isser, back in his seat at the cafeteria, heard the characteristic rumbling of the Whispering Giant's engines. The plane taxied to the terminal and stopped at its departure gate. Isser walked swiftly to the departure hall and looked around. In odd corners, he saw his men, standing beside their luggage. Isser walked around to them, and as he approached each of the agents, he whispered, "Get on the plane." They moved casually and joined the line to passport control. All had their passports ready, and Shalom Dani had done a fine job with them. 11:45 p.m. Having passed immigration and customs without any problems, the group went through the departure gate and walked toward the plane. Isser was the last to pick up his luggage, go through the checkpoints, and get on the plane, which almost immediately moved out to the runway. 00:00, the night between May 20th and 21st. The plane stopped. A delay was ordered by the control tower. The agents were all tense with anxiety. Had something happened? Had a last-minute tip reached the Argentinian police? Would they be ordered to turn back? But after a few minutes of terrifying anxiety, the plane was finally cleared. The Whispering Giant took off over the silvery waters of Rio de la Plata. Isser breathed a sigh of relief. "I have to inform the Knesset." May 22nd. The plane landed at Lod Airport early in the morning. At 9:50 a.m., Isser came directly to Jerusalem. Ben-Gurion secretary, Yitzhak Navon, immediately ushered him into the prime minister's office. Ben-Gurion was surprised. "When did you arrive?" "2 hours ago. We got Eichmann." "Where is he?" the old man asked. "Here, in Israel. Adolf Eichmann is in Israel, and if you agree, we'll deliver him to the police right away." Ben-Gurion fell silent. He didn't burst into tears, as some journalists later reported, nor did he laugh triumphantly, as others wrote. He didn't hug Isser or show any emotion. "Are you sure that this is Eichmann?" he asked. "How did you identify him?" Isser, surprised, answered yes. He detailed for Ben-Gurion all the criteria by which Eichmann had been identified and stressed that the prisoner himself had admitted that he was Adolf Eichmann. But the old man was not entirely satisfied. "Not enough," he said. Before he would authorize any further steps, he wanted one or two people who had known Eichmann to meet him and formally identify him. He needed to be 100% sure, and he wouldn't say a word about this to his government until then. Isser called his office and ordered his staff to find some people who could identify Eichmann personally. In no time, they located two Israelis who, in the past, had met Eichmann. They were brought to the cell where he was being held, spoke with him, and formally identified him. At midday, an Israeli envoy burst into a restaurant in Frankfurt and rushed to one of the tables, where a white-haired man, visibly nervous and tense, sat alone. "Herr Bauer," he said, "Adolf Eichmann is now in our hands. Our men have captured him and brought him to Israel. At any moment we can expect a statement in the Knesset by the Prime Minister." Bauer, pale and deeply moved, got up. His hands were trembling. The man who had given the Mossad Eichmann's address in Argentina, the man without whom Eichmann would likely have never been caught, couldn't restrain himself anymore. He burst into tears, grasped the Israeli's shoulder, hugged him, and kissed him. 4 p.m. At the Knesset plenary session, Ben-Gurion got on the speaker's podium. In a firm, clear voice, he read a short statement. "I have to inform the Knesset that the security services of Israel have just recently laid hands on one of the greatest of Nazi criminals, Adolf Eichmann, who was responsible with other Nazi leaders for what they called the final solution, that is to say, the extermination of 6 million European Jews. Eichmann is at present under arrest here in Israel. He will soon be put on trial in Israel in accordance with the law on the crimes of the Nazis and their collaborators." Ben-Gurion's words were received with shock and wonder, which turned into huge, spontaneous applause. Amazement and admiration spread through the Knesset and throughout the world. At the end of the Knesset session, a man got up from his seat behind the government bench. Few knew his face or his name. It was Isser Harel. The trial of Adolf Eichmann opened in Jerusalem on April 11, 1961. 110 Holocaust survivors were the witnesses for the prosecution. Some had never before spoken of their past, and now told their horrendous stories. It was as if the entire state of Israel was glued to the radio and followed with great pain and horror the dreadful story that emerged from the testimonies. And it felt as if the entire Jewish people identified with the prosecutor, Gideon Hausner, who confronted the Nazi criminal as the representative of his 6 million victims. On December 15, 1961, Eichmann was sentenced to death. His appeal was rejected by the Supreme Court, and pardon was refused by President Yitzhak Ben-Zvi. On May 31, 1962, Adolf Eichmann was informed that his end was imminent. In his cell, the condemned man wrote a few letters to his family and drank half a bottle of red caramel wine. Toward midnight, the Reverend Hull, a nonconformist minister, entered Eichmann's cell, as he had on previous occasions. "Tonight I shall not discuss the Bible with you," Eichmann said to him. "I have no time to lose." The minister left, but then an unexpected visitor walked into Eichmann's cell, Rafi Eitan. The abductor stood facing the condemned man, dressed in a prisoner's light brown uniform. Eitan said nothing. Eichmann looked at him and said in German, "I hope that your turn will come after mine." The guards led Eichmann to a tiny room that had been converted to an execution chamber. He was placed on a trap door and a noose was slipped over his neck. A small group of officials, journalists, and a doctor, all allowed to be present at the execution, heard his last words, spoken in the Nazi tradition. "We'll meet again. I have lived believing in God. I obeyed the laws of war and was loyal to my flag." Two police officers behind a screen simultaneously pressed two buttons, only one of which worked the trap door. Neither knew who had the controlling button, so the name of Eichmann's executioner remains unknown. Eitan didn't see the actual execution, but heard the thud of the trapdoor. Eichmann's body was incinerated in an aluminum oven in the prison courtyard. Black smoke rose toward the sky, wrote an American reporter. No one said a word, but it was impossible not to recall the crematoriums at Auschwitz. Shortly before dawn, on June 1, 1962, a swift boat of Israel's Coast Guard passed beyond Israel's territorial waters. The engine was turned off, and while the boat drifted silently, a police officer cast Eichmann's ashes into the Mediterranean. The wind and the waves dispersed the remains of the man who 20 years earlier had merrily declared, "I'll jump laughing into the grave, happy at having exterminated 6 million Jews." At the deathbed of his mother, Zvi Malkin thought of his massacred relatives, of his sister Fruma and her small children, perished in the Holocaust. He bent toward his mother and whispered to her, "Mother, I got Eichmann. Fruma is avenged."
"I knew you wouldn't forget your sister," the dying woman whispered.
Chapter 7. Where is Yosele? While Isser, his agents, and the captive Eichmann were waiting in their Buenos Aires safe houses for the arrival of the Britannia whispering giant aircraft from Tel Aviv, the Ramzad was busy with another project. Isser had decided to check the rumors that another Nazi criminal was hiding in the city, Dr. Josef Mengele, the Angel of Death, the monstrous doctor who would receive the trainloads of Jews on the Auschwitz platform and indifferently send the healthy-looking ones to work and the weaker, the women, children, and old people, to the gas chambers. Mengele had become a symbol of the Third Reich's cruelty and madness. After the war, he vanished, quite possibly to Argentina. Mengele came from a rich family. While he was in hiding, they continued to support him, funneling large sums of money to him. The money trail, followed by Mossad agents, led to Buenos Aires. Yet, so far, they had failed in their efforts to find Mengele. But this time, they were lucky. In May 1960, shortly before the Britannia landed in Buenos Aires, Isser's agents found Mengele's address. The man was living in Buenos Aires under his real name. Apparently, he was sure he was well protected. Isser sent his best investigator, Zvi Aharoni, to check the address, but Mengele was not at home. His neighbors told Aharoni that the Mengele couple had left for a few days, but they would soon be back. Excited, Isser summoned Rafi Eitan. "Let's watch and follow," he said. "And when Mengele comes back, we'll kidnap him too and bring him to Israel together with Eichmann." Rafi refused. "The Eichmann operation is very complex," he said. "We captured one man, and we have a good chance of succeeding in getting him on the plane and bringing him to Israel. But another operation for the capture of a second man would increase the risks tremendously. It would be a serious mistake." Isser gave in, and Rafi made him an alternative offer. "If you bring Eichmann to Israel and keep his capture secret for a week, I'll bring you Mengele." "How will you do that?" Isser asked. "We still have a few safe houses in Buenos Aires from the Eichmann operation, which nobody knows about. Let's keep them. When you take off with Eichmann on your way to Israel, I'll fly with Zvi Malkin and Avraham Shalom to one of Argentina's neighboring countries. You'll arrive in Israel and keep Eichmann's capture secret. Nobody will know we did it, and nobody will look for us. We'll return to Buenos Aires then. We'll take Mengele. We'll keep him in one of our safe houses, and after a few days, we'll bring him to Israel." Isser agreed. When the Britannia, with Eichmann on board, took off for Israel, Eitan, Shalom, and Malkin flew to Santiago, the capital of neighboring Chile. They intended to return to Buenos Aires after a day or two, if Eichmann's capture was kept secret, and to launch Operation Mengele. But the following morning, all the world's media announced in their headlines the capture of Eichmann in Argentina by the Israelis. It was out of the question that some of the leading Mossad agents would return to Argentina and carry out another kidnapping. Rafi and his friends had to abandon their project and return to Israel. Later, Isser Harel told Rafi that he had asked Ben-Gurion to keep Eichmann's capture secret for a week, but the old man had refused. "Too many people know already that Eichmann is in our hands," Ben-Gurion allegedly said to Isser. "We won't be able to keep the secret any longer. I've decided to inform the Knesset of his capture this afternoon." Eichmann's capture was announced, and Israel lost its chance to bring to trial one of the most sadistic criminals in history. Shortly after the Eichmann capture, Mengele felt the ground was burning under his feet. He moved to Paraguay and vanished until his death of a heart attack almost 20 years later, in February 1979. In early March 1962, Isser Harel was summoned by Ben-Gurion. The old man greeted him warmly, chatting with him for a while about various subjects. "What does he want?" Isser wondered. He knew Ben-Gurion well and was sure that he hadn't invited Isser in for small talk. The two men liked each other and were similar. They were both short, stubborn, and decisive, born leaders of men, dedicated to Israel's security. They both weren't ones to waste time and words, and since Eichmann's capture, they had become much closer. All of a sudden, in the middle of the conversation, Ben-Gurion turned to Isser. "Tell me, can you find the child?" He didn't say what child he was talking about, but Isser understood right away. For the last 2 years, one question kept popping up all over Israel, screaming from newspaper headlines, shouted from the Knesset podium, and angrily thrown in the faces of ultra-Orthodox Jews by secular youth. "Where is Yosela?" Yosela was Yosela Schuchmacher, an 8-year-old boy from the city of Holon, who had been kidnapped by ultra-Orthodox Jews, headed by his grandfather. The old Hasid wanted to raise Yosela in the ultra-Orthodox tradition and had snatched the child from his parents. Since then, the boy had vanished without a trace. Each day he remained missing, the dispute over the child grew, from a family affair to a national scandal to an increasingly violent confrontation between secular and ultra-Orthodox Jews. Some feared a civil war could erupt and tear the nation apart. As a last resort, Ben-Gurion turned to Isser. "If you want me to, I'll try," Isser said. He drove back to his office and had an operational file opened. He called it Operation Tiger Cub. Yosela was a good-looking, vivacious child. His only mistake, apparently, had been to choose the wrong parents. That was the opinion of his grandfather, Nachman Starkus. Old Starkus, skeletal, bearded, and bespectacled, was a fanatical Hasid, a man tough and stubborn. Nobody could break him, neither the KGB thugs nor the Soviet labor camps in frozen Siberia, where he had spent a part of World War II. In Siberia, he had lost an eye and 3 toes from frostbite, but his morale had remained intact. His vicissitudes had only fueled his hatred for the Soviets, which peaked in 1951 when a gang of hoodlums stabbed his son to death. He consoled himself with his other 2 sons, Shalom and Ovadia, and his daughter Ida, who was married to a tailor. The young couple lived for a while in Starkus's old home in Lvov, where they had settled after wandering through Russia and Poland. There, in 1953, the 2nd child in the Schuchmacher family was born, Yosela. The boy was 4 years old when he immigrated to Israel with his parents. Grandfather and grandmother Starkus and one of their sons, Shalom, had arrived in Israel a few months earlier. Nachman Starkus, who belonged to the Breslau Hasidim sect, settled in Mea Sherim, the ultra-Orthodox sector of Jerusalem. It was another world of men wearing long black coats or silk caftans, black hats or fur hats, bushy beards and long sidelocks, women in long prim dresses covering their hair with wigs or scarves, a world of yeshivas, synagogues, courts of famous rabbis. Shalom joined a yeshiva. His other brother, Ovadia, moved to England. Ida and Alta Schuchmacher settled in Holon. Eventually, Alta got a job in a textile factory in the Tel Aviv area. Ida was hired by a photographer. They bought a small apartment and struggled to make a living. They went deeply into debt. To make ends meet, they sent their daughter, Zina, to a religious institution at Kfar Chabad and entrusted Yosela to his grandparents. Rocked by hard times, Ida and Alta Schuchmacher wrote to friends in Russia that perhaps they shouldn't have come to Israel. Some of the replies to the couple's complaints fell in the hands of old Nachman Starkus. He concluded that the Schuchmachers intended to go back to Russia with their children. Seething with fury, he decided not to give Yosela back to his parents. By the end of 1959, though, the Schuchmachers' economic situation improved. They were better off now, and they decided to reunite their family. In December, Ida went to Jerusalem to pick up her child, but neither Yosela nor his grandfather was home. "Tomorrow your brother Shalom will bring the boy to you," Ida's mother said. "Right now he is with his grandfather at the synagogue, and you must not disturb them." On the following day, though, Shalom arrived in Holon alone and told his sister that their father had decided not to give back Yosela. The distraught Ida rushed to Jerusalem with her husband. They spent the weekend at the Starkus house, and that time Yosela was there. On Saturday evening, when they were about to leave with the child, Ida's mother objected. "It's very cold outside," she said. "Let the child sleep here, and tomorrow I'll bring him back to you." They agreed. Ida kissed her son, who curled up in his bed, and left with her husband. How could she know that years would pass before she saw her little boy again? The following day, neither Yosela nor his grandmother showed up in Holon. Once again, Ida and Alta got on the road to Jerusalem, but to no avail. The child had vanished, and old Starkus bluntly refused to return him despite Ida's tears. Her son was gone. After a few more trips, Ida and Alta realized that the old man wouldn't give them back their child or disclose his whereabouts. In January 1960, they decided to turn to the courts. They lodged a complaint against Nachman Starkus at the Tel Aviv Rabbinical Court. Starkus didn't answer, and their nightmare began. January 15th, Israel's Supreme Court orders Nachman Starkus to return the child to his parents within 30 days and summons him to court. He replies 2 days later, "I cannot come because of my poor health." February 17th, the family lodges a complaint with the police and asks that Nachman Starkus be arrested and held in custody until he returns their son. The Supreme Court orders the police to find the child. 10 days later, the police open a file for Yosela and the search begins. April 7th, the police cannot find any trace of the boy and ask the Supreme Court to be relieved of the search. May 12th. Indignant, the Supreme Court orders the police to continue with the search and finally orders the arrest of Nachman Starkus. He is taken into custody the next day. But if anyone had thought that a stay in jail would break old Starkus's resolve, they were dead wrong. The tough old man didn't say a word. It became immediately evident that Starkus hadn't hidden the child by himself and had been helped by a network of ultra-Orthodox Jews who had deceived the police. They had all engaged in a sacrosanct mission to thwart the devious plan of taking the child to Russia and converting him to Christianity, or so Starkus had told them. Even Rabbi Frank, chief rabbi of Jerusalem, published a ruling supporting old Starkus and urging the Orthodox community to help him in every way. The question appeared on the Knesset agenda in May 1960, and the press had a field day. The first to realize the far-reaching implications of the affair were the representatives of the religious parties. Knesset member Shlomo Lorenz felt that the abduction of the child might ignite a religious war in Israel. He offered to Starkus and the Schuchmacher family his services as a go-between. He brought to Starkus, who was still in jail, a draft agreement saying that the parents promised to give the child an Orthodox education. Starkus agreed to sign the paper on one condition, that Rabbi Mazish, one of the most fanatical rabbis in Jerusalem, would order him to do so. Lawrence hurried to Jerusalem and met with the rabbi. Mazish implied that he'd consent to the agreement only on condition that the abductors wouldn't be prosecuted. Now Lawrence went to the chief of police, Joseph Namias. "I agree," Namias said. "Take my car and bring the child. You have parliamentary immunity and no one would follow my car anyway, so the people involved will remain unknown." Overjoyed, Lawrence returned to Rabbi Mazish, but the rabbi changed his mind. Lawrence was back at square one. He knew that the child was probably hidden in one of the religious communities, Talmudic schools, or Orthodox villages, but impeded by a wall of silence, finding the child there was an impossible mission. On April 12, 1961, Nachman Starkus was released from jail for reasons of health, after he had promised he'd try to find the little boy. But he didn't keep his word, and the Supreme Court had him arrested again, stating that the abduction was a shocking and despicable crime. In August 1961, a National Committee for the Return of Yosala was created, and it started distributing leaflets, organizing public meetings, alerting the media. Many thousands signed its petitions. The sinister shadow of a cultural war loomed on the horizon. In August 1961, the police raided the Hasidic village Komemut, only to find out that the bird had flown the coop. Yosala had been hidden in the village a year and a half before, in December 1959, when his uncle Shalom had brought him to the home of a Mr. Zalman Kot. The child was hidden under the name Israel Hazak. In the meantime, though, the child had been whisked away, and Shalom Starkus had left the country and settled in the Hasidic community Golders Green in London. On the demand of the Israeli police, Starkus was arrested by the British. When his first child, Kalman, was born, his family brought the baby to the prison where the circumcision ritual was performed. But Yosala was gone, without a trace. Some believed that he had been smuggled out of the country, or even got sick and died. The police became a laughingstock. Violent clashes erupted between secular and Orthodox Jews. Yeshiva students were caught and beaten in the street by passers-by. Secular youngsters taunted Orthodox youths with the cries, "Where is Yosala?" The fury of the Israeli public reached its boiling point. Stormy debates shook the Knesset. That's when Ben-Gurion called Isser. When Isser Harel agreed to assume the search for Yosala, he didn't realize that he was accepting the most difficult and complicated assignment of his career. He never used to discuss operational matters with his wife, Rivka, but this time he told her, "The authority of the government is at stake." One of his best agents, Avraham Shalom, had a different opinion. Isser wanted to prove that he could succeed where the police had failed. The police were only too happy to palm off their unwanted task. Joseph Namias, the chief of police, asked Isser, "Do you really believe it is possible to find the child?" Amos Manner, the head of the Shabak and Isser's close collaborator, was against the entire project. Many of the Mossad and the Shabak senior officers agreed. They all thought that this assignment was outside their duties, They were supposed to work for the security of Israel and not chase a kid in Hasidic schools. Unlike Isser, they didn't believe the Secret Service served to preserve the reputation of the Jewish state. Yet, once Isser had made up his mind, they didn't contest his decision. His authority was absolute. Isser and his assistants created a task force of about 40 agents, the best Shabak investigators, members of the operational team, religious agents or people posing as such, and even civilians who volunteered for the operation. Most of the volunteers were members of the Orthodox community who realized the danger that Yosela's abduction posed for the nation. But their first operations ended in dismal failure. They crudely tried to penetrate the ultra-Orthodox bastions and were immediately recognized, mocked, and rejected. "I felt as if I had landed on Mars," said one of Isser's agents, "and had to blend in among a crowd of little green men without being noticed." Isser patiently studied the file, reading and rereading each document. There was no trace of Yosela anywhere in Israel. Isser finally reached a conclusion. The child had been taken out of the country. Out of the country, but where? A strange piece of news drew his attention. In mid-March 1962, a large group of Hasidic Jews had traveled to Israel from Switzerland. Scores of men, women, and children came to escort the coffin of their venerated rabbi and bury him in the Holy Land. Isser came to suspect that the funeral was just a cover story used to spirit Yosela out of the country when the group returned to Switzerland a few weeks later. Isser posted his men at the airport and sent a small team of his men, headed by Avraham Shalom, to Zurich to follow the Hasidim on their return. The Mossad agents even went to the children's boarding school and snuck into its courtyard at night to peek in the windows and scrutinize every child. "We reached this yeshiva in the middle of the forest," Shalom recalled. "We stuck to the windows. We knew he might be disguised, but we looked for a child that could be of the same age." After a week of nightly adventures, he had to report to Isser that Yosela definitely was not among the Swiss children. Isser decided to assume command of the operation. He placed all pending matters into the hands of his aides, settled in an improvised headquarters in Paris, and sent his men all over the world. They carried out investigations in France, Italy, Switzerland, Belgium, England, South America, the United States, and North Africa. Using different covers, they tried to penetrate Orthodox yeshivas and communities in order to list the centers where the child could be hidden. A young Orthodox Jew from Jerusalem arrived in the famous yeshiva of Rabbi Soloveitchik in Switzerland, posing as a scholar who came to study the Torah with the renowned master. A modest religious woman, pious and devout, arrived in London, carrying warm letters of recommendation from Shalom Starkus's mother-in-law, whose trust she had won. She was invited by the Starkus family to stay with them as their house guest. They didn't know that the good woman was Yehudit Nisiyahu, Isser's best female agent who had participated in Eichmann's abduction. Yehudit wasn't the only Mossad agent operating in London these days. London was an important center of ultra-Orthodox Hasidim of the Satmar sect, named after the Romanian village Satu Mare, where the sect had originated. Isser sent another team of agents to the Hasidim residential neighborhoods in London. Another team rushed to Ireland. During the operations in England, Isser's men had stumbled upon a young religious couple who had suddenly rented an isolated house in Ireland. The Mossad agents believed that the couple would use the house as the new hideout for Yosela and prepared a detailed plan for the capture of the child. Hurriedly, they rented apartments and cars, smuggled equipment, prepared false documents. The operation was planned to the smallest detail. And then the failures came. The first to return home frustrated was the Ireland team. It turned out that the religious couple was indeed a religious couple. They had just decided to go on vacation to Ireland. Yehudit Nisiyahu also failed to obtain any information from the Starkus family, and the young man who went to study the Holy Scriptures in Switzerland returned enlightened but empty-handed. From all over the world, negative answers poured into Isser's headquarters. The child had vanished. The worst fate awaited the team that tried to penetrate the Satmar Hasidim in London. Some young, smart yeshiva students in the Stamford Hill neighborhood immediately made the uninvited guests and confronted them, shouting, "Here come the Zionists! Come, Yosala is here!" They even called the London police. Isser's assistants had to work hard to spring their colleagues from Her Majesty's jail. One after another, Isser's most devout supporters lost hope. They told him, "Isser, it won't work. Call off the hunt. You're looking for a needle in a haystack. We won't find the child." But he didn't give up. Stubborn as a bulldog, he waved off all the doubts and complaints and continued, obsessed by the search and confident that even against all odds, he would find the child. In Paris, he summoned Yaakov Karoz, the head of the Mossad station. Karoz, born in Romania, had lost his parents in the Holocaust and had been involved in espionage and security matters since his studies at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Slim, with a clear forehead, delicate features, and eyeglasses, Karoz had the outward appearance of an intellectual. He was the former head of Tevel, Universe, the Mossad department in charge of covert relations with foreign secret services, and had forged some of Israel's most secret and unexpected alliances. He had helped build a peripheral pact between Israel and Iran, Ethiopia, Turkey, and even Sudan, all non-Arab countries on the periphery of the Middle East. He had established close cooperation with the heads of the French, British, and German secret services. He had struck an alliance with the formidable General Ufkir, Morocco's dreaded Minister of Interior, and secretly visited Morocco's King Hassan. He had even helped the Ethiopian Emperor Haile Selassie crush an attempted coup by his closest aides. During an undercover mission in Algeria, he had fallen in love with a young woman, Juliet Yael, who became his wife. Karoz, soft-spoken and deceptively polite, was a master spy in a suit and tie who had never acted as a field agent, yet he was a man of the world who spoke fluent French and English, which made him a valuable asset for Isser. Isser worked around the clock. He had rented a hotel room but spent most of his days and nights in the apartment that he had turned into his operational headquarters. His assistants bought him a folding cot. They called it Yosala's bed, and once in a while he would collapse on it for a short nap. That lasted for months. Most of the time he was busy checking reports, writing telegrams, and talking to his men, who were dispersed all over Europe. At dawn he would leave his office and go to his hotel, where he showered, freshened up, and returned to work. On the first night, as he returned to the hotel in the wee hours, the porter flashed him an appreciative smile. This little gentleman apparently enjoyed Paris's nightlife to the full. The second night, the porter allowed himself to address a friendly wink to the gentleman. But when the nightly adventures continued in the third and fourth and fifth nights, the porter couldn't keep his cool anymore. When Isser returned at dawn, his eyes red from lack of sleep, his face covered with stubble, his clothes ruffled, the porter theatrically removed his hat, bowed, and declared, "My respects, monsieur." Then, one April morning, a curious report reached the Mossad agents. It had been dispatched by a young Orthodox Jew named Meir, who had been sent to Antwerp, Belgium. There, he had become acquainted with a group of religious diamond merchants who followed old Rabbi Itzakel and considered him to be a holy man. When they wanted to solve their business disputes, they didn't seek help from the state courts. Instead, asked the rabbi to be the mediator and the judge, often for deals worth many millions. His word was law. Even in modern-day Europe, this particular group of merchants observed the customs of ancient times. Meir succeeded in penetrating the circle of the rabbi's followers and learned that during World War II they had acted as an anti-Nazi underground and had saved many Jews from the Gestapo. After the war, the group continued using the same methods and experience they had acquired as an underground organization to engage in business ventures throughout the world. The diamond merchants told Meir an extraordinary story about a blonde, blue-eyed Frenchwoman, a Catholic, who had been part of their organization during the war, helping them to rescue Jews from Hitler's grasp. The woman had been profoundly influenced by the rabbi's charisma. She converted to Judaism and became devoutly Orthodox, and more so, a priceless asset for the group. Her years in the underground had taught her a lot. She was bright, daring. She knew how to cover her tracks, change disguises, and use her charm as a weapon. Besides, she had an instinct for business and a keen natural intelligence. She had traveled the world on missions for the Antwerp group with her French passport. "She's a holy woman," the Antwerp Jews told Meir. They also told him that she had visited Israel. Her son, from her first marriage, Claude, had also converted, and after studying in yeshivas in Switzerland and Aix-les-Bains, was now a student at a Talmudic school in Jerusalem. But even the Antwerp people didn't know where the fabulous holy woman was now. That story fired up Isser's imagination. On the face of it, there was nothing in the report to connect the French woman to Yosela, but in Isser's eyes, she appeared as a person with enormous potential, a woman with a thousand faces. She could be a real godsend for the Orthodox leaders if they needed somebody to set out on secret missions concerning Yosela. Isser decided to follow his intuition, abandon all other leads, and concentrate on the mysterious convert. He cabled to Israel all the details he knew and instructed his service to find the son and his mother. A few days later, the answer came. The son's name was now Ariel, and he was in Israel indeed, yet nobody knew where his mother was. Her name was originally Madeleine Ferrai. In Israel, she was called Ruth Ben David. The reports streaming to Isser's headquarters painted a more accurate picture of Madeleine Ferrai. The pretty young woman had studied history and geography at the Toulouse University and the Sorbonne in Paris. She had married her college sweetheart, Henri, and their son was born shortly after the outbreak of World War II. Madeleine had joined the Maquis resistance during the war, and her underground activities had brought her into contact with French and Belgian Jews, among them the Antwerp group. At the war's end, she even initiated joint import-export ventures with some of them. In 1951, she divorced Henri after falling in love with a young rabbi in a small Alsatian town. The rabbi, a fervent Zionist, wanted to emigrate to Israel, and the two lovers decided to marry there. Her conversion to Judaism, therefore, was not so much for love of the religion itself as for love of one of its adherents. The recently converted Ruth Ben David tied a scarf on her blonde hair, changed her elegant clothes for the shapeless vestments of an Orthodox Jewess, and followed her fiancé to the Holy Land. But in Israel, the affair turned sour. The rabbi left her, and she remained alone, depressed and frustrated. Her personal crisis apparently motivated her to approach the most extremist circles in Jerusalem and their leader, Rabbi Mezish. She gained a lot of respect in the religious circles after using her French passport to cross into the Jordanian sector of Jerusalem and pray at the Wailing Wall. In the early 50s, Ruth returned to France and started traveling extensively again. The Mossad agents found out that she often stayed in Aix-les-Bains, or in a religious women's institution close to Paris. But she had no permanent address. The immigration authorities informed Isser's men that in the last few years, Ruth had visited Israel twice. The second time, on June 21, 1960, she had left Israel with a little girl, who was recorded in her passport as her daughter. She had departed on an Alitalia flight, and her final destination was Zurich. But who was the small girl? Ben David had no daughter. Isser felt that he was on the right track. "Find her," he said to Yaakov Karoz. Armed with a detailed description of the woman, Karoz and another agent set out for Aix-les-Bains. But as they drove into the small town, they saw something amazing. Ruth Ben David, or in this case, Madeleine Ferraille, elegantly dressed, stood by the road hitchhiking. They were startled. Elegant, refined French women trying to thumb a ride on the roads of France were not a common sight, to say the least. The driver immediately made a U-turn and darted toward the lady, but another car stopped ahead of him and departed with the pretty woman. The agents returned from Aix-les-Bains empty-handed, but from another source they learned that Ruth Ben David kept close ties with Joseph Dombes, a rich London jewel merchant. She had been sighted sitting alone with Dombes in an automobile, which was inappropriate for a Hasidic man. Isser knew of Dombes. He was a staunch enemy of the State of Israel. He belonged to the Satmar Hasidic sect, was a close confidant of the Satmar rabbi in New York, and knew the major Satmar leaders in various communities in Europe. "If the Satmar rabbi in New York is the Pope," one expert told Isser, "then Dombes is his archbishop." Isser realized that all the roads led to London. Here lived the two sons of old Starkus. Here was based an active community of the Satmar sect, led by Dombes. Here he was seen with Ruth Ben David, who might have smuggled Yosala out of Israel. Isser had no more doubts. It had to be the Satmar Hasidim in Israel and Europe who had orchestrated the kidnapping of the child. Dombes had been in charge of the operation. Ruth Ben David had been instrumental in the abduction because of her talents, her experience, and her French passport. She might know where the child was hidden. His suspicions were confirmed by a Shabak agent who intercepted several letters Ruth Ben David had written to her son. They contained some veiled hints about Yosala Schuckmacher. Yet Isser needed more information. He decided to penetrate the Satmar Hasidim. His men in London identified a mohel, a rabbi who specialized in the circumcision of newborn Jewish boys, named Friar, not his real name. He was a chatterbox, a man with a taste for life's pleasures under a cloak of righteousness, and, last but not least, a man who was close to Dombes and claimed that he knew where Yosala was. Isser launched a complicated operation, intended to bring Friar to Paris. One of his men, posing as a Moroccan prince, came secretly to Friar and told him he had fallen in love with a Jewish girl. They had married in secret and kept the Jewish faith at home, in Morocco. Now his wife had given birth to a baby boy, and he wanted him circumcised, but couldn't do it in Morocco. His family would murder him if they only knew. His wife and child were in Paris. Would Rabbi Friar come to circumcise the baby? He would be handsomely rewarded. Friar readily agreed, and a few days later arrived in Paris. The moment he stepped into the apartment of the Moroccan prince, he was apprehended by Mossad agents. They escorted him to a bare room, where he was interrogated for hours by Victor Cohen, the head of the Shabak Investigation Department. The mohel was scared to death, offered no resistance, and was ready to talk. But when asked about Yosala, he raised his hands. I am dreadfully sorry, he said, but I don't know a thing. It turned out, indeed, that Friar knew nothing about the abducted child, and all his braggadocio was just intended to impress his friends. Once again, Isser's efforts hit a wall. Surprisingly, another team of his men had struck gold. With the help of the French Secret Service, they had succeeded in intercepting several letters sent to Madeleine Ferrai, and in one of them, they found the opportunity they were looking for. It was a reply to a newspaper ad offering for sale her country house in Orléans, a lovely city in the Garden of France, the Loire Valley. They dispatched a letter to the post office box given in the advertisement and offered Ferrai more than she was asking for her house. They claimed they were Austrian businessmen looking for a location for their vacations. Madeleine Ferrai answered, giving the address of her house. Soon after, they wrote to her again, saying they had visited it and it suited their needs. They fixed an appointment for closing the deal on June 21, 1962, in the lobby of a big hotel in Paris. A few days before the appointment, Isser's men arrived in Paris one by one and engaged in feverish activity. They rented cars and safe houses in Paris and its suburbs, established escape routes, prepared documents and equipment, and brought from Israel experts in surveillance and interrogation. Isser also decided that the best means to make Ruth Ben David spill her secrets was through her son. Ariel studied in a yeshiva in Israel and apparently knew a lot about Yosela. Isser decided to arrest him simultaneously with his mother's abduction in France. Ariel was Orthodox, but less fanatical than his mother. Isser established a system of communication that would enable the Mossad agents to synchronize the questioning of Ruth with that of her son in Israel, so they could use the answers of the son for the questioning of the mother. And indeed, on the morning of June 21st, a tall, elegant, strikingly beautiful woman walked into the hotel lobby. This was Madeleine Ferrai. The charming Frenchwoman introduced herself to the two Austrians who were waiting for her. One of them was Herr Ferber, the other Herr Schmidt. She spoke excellent English and also had a good command of German. She never suspected the identity of her two buyers. They quickly reached an agreement about the sale of the house, but their lawyer was late. Ferber called him from one of the hotel phone booths. When he came back, he said that the lawyer had profusely apologized. He had been detained at home, he said, by several urgent matters. He had asked if they could come to his house in the town of Chantilly, close to the city, and gave Ferber the address and detailed directions. He would receive them immediately and they would sign all the papers on the spot. "Shall we go?" Ferber asked. Madeleine agreed. They got into the two Austrians' rental car and drove to the lawyer's villa. But the Frenchwoman's charm almost caused the failure of the entire operation. Ferber, the agent at the wheel, was so entranced by Madeleine that he went through a red light. The strident shriek of a whistle brought him back to reality. A fat, angry police officer was running toward him, blowing his whistle and pointing to the red light. Ferber stopped the car, fraught by ominous premonitions. What should he do? He was in a foreign country with phony papers, driving a rented car with a woman who was about to disappear. He would get a traffic ticket, a procedure against him would be initiated by the police, and... But Madeleine Ferrai, who had caused all his troubles, was also the one who came to his rescue. She stuck her head out of the window and flashed a charming smile at the police officer. "Monsieur l'agent," she said sweetly, "this man is a tourist. He is in a foreign country, travels with a woman, and tries to amuse her with his stories. You certainly can understand that. Please forgive him." The police officer, too, was entranced by the lady's charm and let the panic-stricken agents off without even writing a ticket. Presently, the car entered the beautiful town of Chantilly, where the lawyer lived. They entered the villa's driveway and stopped before the main entrance. The two businessmen politely helped their guest out of the car, escorted her to the house. The door opened, and she walked in. She was led to the lawyer's office. The part of the lawyer was played by Yakov Karoz. "Madame," he said in French, "you are not here to discuss your house in Orléans, but another matter."
"What? What's going on?"
"I want to talk to you about the child Yosela Schuchmacher." At that moment, two other men materialized at her side. When she turned back, she realized that the two businessmen had vanished without a trace. She was struck with fear.
"I've fallen into a trap," she hoarsely whispered in French.
"You've fallen in the hands of the Israeli services, madame," Karoz said. At that very moment, police officers arrested Ariel Ben David, the French woman's son, in the town of Be'er Yaakov, in Israel. In Chantilly, Karoz turned to Ruth Ben David. "Madame, you are involved in the abduction of Yosela Schuchmacher. We want the child."
"I know nothing and I'll say nothing," she answered firmly.
After the initial shock, she had recovered quickly. Karoz had brought over his sister-in-law, a trained nurse, to stand by in case of emergency. The Israelis understood that Ruth was their last hope, but they also assumed that this iron lady would not break easily, and that might take quite a while. She was handed over to Yehudit Nisiyahu, who had arrived from London. Nisiyahu treated her well and took care of her needs as a religious woman. She provided her with prayer books and candles for the Sabbath. She cooked kosher food for her. The wing where she was kept was out of bounds for men. The nurse occupied the room next to hers. The interrogation started. The convert spent hours facing the agents, mostly Yaakov Karoz and Victor Cohen, who addressed her in French. She was amazed to discover that the Israelis knew all about her, but she stubbornly refused to reveal any information about Yosela.
"I'll say nothing," she kept repeating.
She called Victor Cohen Flic, which in French slang means cop. She stubbornly denied any connection with the abduction. "So I started to talk to her about all kinds of subjects," Victor Cohen recalled later. "Just to soften her. I wanted to understand how a Christian girl had become a fanatical Orthodox. These are two different worlds. At first, when we spoke, she insisted that there had to be another woman in the room with us. Later, she agreed to sit alone with me, but the door had to remain open." One of her interrogators was charged with the unpleasant duty of throwing insulting accusations in her face in order to make her lose her calm. The Mossad men hoped that she would react impulsively and blurt out things she didn't mean to say. They could be used in the simultaneous interrogation of her son in Israel. And indeed, the interrogation of Ariel Ben David started bearing fruit. The chief investigator in Israel was Avraham Hadar, a tough guy incongruously codenamed Pashosh, Thrush. He told the young man that his mother had capitulated. "Your mother has confessed to everything," he said. "Your lies will get you nowhere. Tell the truth." And after a while, Ariel broke down. He said he knew what had happened to the child and would talk, "only if my mother and I get immunity." Pashosh told him, "You got it." He immediately brought Ariel to Amos Manor, the head of the Shabak. As they entered, Manor yelled at Ariel, "Whatever Pashosh promised you, I agree. Now, where is the child?" Ariel was shaken. He finally admitted that his mother had smuggled Yosela out of Israel, disguised as a little girl. She had forged her passport, where he had been registered under his former name, Claude. She had changed the name to Claudine and also changed the birth date so it could fit Yosela's age. He knew that the child had been taken to Switzerland. Ariel's confession was rushed to Chantilly, and Ruth Ben-David's interrogators confronted her with the new facts. "Ariel is in our hands," Victor Cohen told her. "He is facing stiff punishment. He has confessed everything. Don't you care what will happen to your son?"
"He is not my son anymore," she muttered. She remained unbreakable. The interrogators couldn't help admiring the tremendous strength of that woman.
Gradually, the situation became untenable. The solution seemed so close, and yet the interrogators felt that everything might end in total failure. Finally, Isser decided, the time had come for him to take over. In the bare, dark room, Isser Harel and Ruth Ben-David faced each other across the table. Some Mossad agents stood behind them. Cohen and Carroz served as interpreters. Isser firmly believed that this fiercely determined woman would not yield to any threats. The only way, he thought, was to convince her with moral arguments. She was religious, indeed, but she would listen to logic. After all, she had not been an ultra-Orthodox Jewess all her life, and the fanaticism of former generations didn't flow in her veins since her birth. She was an intelligent, shrewd woman, and she should be addressed as such. "I represent the Israeli government," Isser said, weighing every word. "Your son has told us everything, and we have a lot of other information about you. Most of your secrets are known to us. We are sorry that we had to bring you here by force. You converted to Judaism, and Judaism means Israel. Without Israel, Judaism would not survive. The abduction of Yosela has dealt a terrible blow to the religious community in Israel. It stirred feelings of fury against the Orthodox. You could be the cause of bloodshed and a civil war. If you don't return the child, a bloody libel may result. Just think what might happen to that child. He could get sick, even die. How could you and your accomplices face his parents then? That would haunt you for the rest of your lives, and you'll never be absolved. You are a woman and a mother. If someone disapproved of the way you're bringing up your son and took him away from you, how would you feel? Could you sleep at night? We are not fighting against religion. Our only purpose is to find the child. As soon as we have him in our hands, you'll go free. Your son will go free. And Israel will be united again." Isser watched as Ruth's face began to show her inner conflict. She seemed torn by contradictory feelings. Ruth was in a state of high tension, fighting against herself as only a strong person can before an uncompromising dilemma. The Mossad agents were motionless like statues. They too believed that the moment of truth had arrived. Ruth raised her head. "How do I know that you are a genuine representative of the State of Israel? How can I trust you?" Without a blink, Isser pulled out his diplomatic passport, issued in his real name, and handed it to Ruth Ben-David. His men were dumbfounded. Has he gone mad? To give her his name and passport, that was a tremendous risk. Isser, however, felt that only if he showed her he was sincere and had confidence in her did he have a chance of success. For a long moment, Ruth gazed at the seal of Israel embossed on the passport. She bit her lips till drops of blood popped on her mouth.
"I can't take it anymore," she murmured. "I am going to break down."
Then, suddenly, she raised her head. "The child is with the Gertner family, 126 Penn Street, Brooklyn, New York. They call him Yankala." Isser jumped to his feet. "As soon as we get the child, you'll be free." He left the room. A feverish exchange of telegrams alerted Jerusalem, then New York and Washington. Isser called Israel Gur Ariyeh, the security officer of the Israeli diplomatic missions in North America. Gur Ariyeh, who was based in New York, checked the Brooklyn address. He cabled back that the address was correct and that the Gertner family lived in a district largely populated by Satmar Hasidim. Jerusalem dispatched a cable to Avraham Harman, Israel's ambassador in Washington, instructing him to contact the FBI and ask them to find the child and deliver him to Israel. Gur Ariyeh himself called his counterpart at the FBI and gave him all the details: what the child eats, what he wears, etc. The FBI agent answered, "If you know so much about him, go get him yourself." Gur Ariyeh replied, "Give me the authorization." The FBI agent refused. Disquieting telegrams began pouring into Isser's headquarters. "The Americans are hesitating," Gur Ariyeh and the Israeli ambassador reported. They ask, "Are you absolutely certain that the child is at that address? What would happen if we raided that house and didn't find the child?" The FBI hinted that their reticence was due to the upcoming congressional elections. The Satmar sect controlled almost 100,000 votes, and the administration didn't want to risk alienating them.